to deal with the ripening body. We were safely past the body and burial detail when I suddenly stopped marching and sent word forward that I would deal with the stewing corpse. I had my reasons, of course. Someone had taken the dead German's boots already, and he'd surely been picked clean of insignia and weaponry and anything else that might make a decent trophy to show to the nephews at Thanksgiving in Rockport. "This is the Hitler battle spoon I took from a murderous Hun I killed using my poor bare feet." But for some reason, this particular dead man still had his socks. And so crazed was I with discomfort that this dead man's socks looked to me like salvation. Two clean, tight-woven sheaths that appeared to cover his feet like bedsheets at a 4-star hotel. After dozens of pairs of Allied replacement socks, courtesy of my empathetic supply sergeant, I'd thought I might try my luck with Axis footwear. "That's sick," Richard said when I told him I was going back for the corpse's socks. "I'm sick," I admitted. But before I could move for the dead man's feet, that moron Silver Bar Lieutenant Bean came astride and said that a mine-rigged body had been encountered by another platoon, and so our most recent orders were to eschew burial detail. I had to walk away from what appeared to be the warmest, driest, cleanest pair of socks in Europe, to march another 2 miles in these soggy, spiky beasts in full pupa stage. And that was it. I was done. I said to Richards, "I'm doing it tonight. S.I.W. I'm blowing off my foot tonight." Richards had been listening to me gripe for days, and he thought I was all talk, that I could no more shoot myself in the foot than I could levitate. "Don't be stupid," Richards said. "War's over." That was what was so perfect, I told him. Who would suspect it now? Earlier in my war, a foot shot might not have been enough to send me home. But now, with the thing winding down, I liked my odds. "I'm gonna do it." Richards indulged me. "Fine, do it. I hope you bleed to death in the stockade. Death would be better than this pain." "Then forget your foot. Shoot yourself in the head." We'd stopped just short of this village and decamped in the rubble of an old barn on a vine-covered hillside. Richards and I set up OP on a small ledge that served as our cover. I sat there debating with Richards which part of my foot I should shoot, as easily as a man might talk about where to have lunch. And that's when a scraping came from the road below us. Richards and I looked at one another silently. I grabbed my carbine, pushed up to the ledge, and rolled my sight along the road below us until I landed on the approaching figure of... a girl? No. A woman. Young. 19? 22? 23? I couldn't say in the dusky light, only that she was lovely, and that she seemed to be bouncing along on this narrow dirt road, brown hair swept up and pinned in back, face narrow at the chin, rising over flushed cheeks to a pair of eyes framed by bursts of black lash, like two lines of oil smoke. She was small, but everyone in the bruised shin of Italy was small. She didn't appear to be starving. She wore a wrap over a dress, and it pains me to not recall the color of that dress. But I believe it was a faded blue with yellow sunflowers, though I can't honestly say it was so, only that I remember it that way. And I find it suspicious that every woman in the Europe of my memory, every whore, grandmother, and waif I encountered, wears the same blue dress with yellow sunflowers. "Halt!" Richards called, and I laughed. Here was a vision on a road beneath us, and Richards comes up with, "Halt!" Had I my wits beneath me instead of brutalized feet, I'd have steered him to the bard's more existential, "Who's there?" And we'd have done the whole of Hamlet for her. "Don't shoot, nice Americans," called the girl from the road in pristine English. Unsure where this halt had come from, she addressed the trees on both sides, then our small ledge before her. "I am walking to see my mother." She held up her hands, and we rose on the hillside above her, rifles still trained. She lowered her hands and said that her name was Maria, and that she was from the village just over the hill. Despite a slight accent, her English was better than most of the guys in our unit. She was smiling. Not until you see a smile like that do you understand how much you've missed it. All I could think about was how long it had been since I'd seen a smiling girl on a country road. "Road's closed. You'll have to walk around," Richard said, pointing with his rifle back the way she'd come. "Yes, fine," she said, and asked if the road to the west was open. Richard said it was. "Thank you," she said, and started back up the road. "God bless America." "Wait," I yelled. "I'll walk you." I took off my wool helmet liner and patted down my hair with spit. "Don't be an idiot," Richard said. I turned, tears in my eyes. "God damn it, Richards. I am walking this girl home." Of course, Richards was right. I was being an idiot. Leaving my post was desertion. But at that moment, I'd have spent the rest of my war in the stockade to walk 6 feet with that girl. "Please let me go," I said. "I'll give you anything." "Your Luger," Richards said without hesitation. I knew this was what Richards would ask for. He coveted that Luger as much as I coveted dry socks. He wanted it as a souvenir for his son. And how could I blame him? I'd been thinking of the son I didn't have when I bought the Luger at a little Italian market outside Pietrasanta. With no son back home, I'd figured to show it to my wayward girlfriends and my lousy nephews after too many whiskeys, when I'd pretend not to want to talk about my war, then would pull the rusted Luger from a bureau and tell the lazy shits how I wrestled it from a crazy German who killed 6 of my men and shot me in the foot. The black market economy of German war trophies depended on such deception. Retreating, starving Germans trading their broken weapons and their identifying insignia to starving Italians for bread, and the starving Italians in turn selling them as trophies to Americans like Richards and me, starved for proof of our heroism. Sadly, Richards never got to give the Luger to his boy. Because 6 days before we shipped home, me to listen to Cubs games on the radio, him to his wife and son, Richards died ingloriously of a blood infection he acquired in a field hospital after surgery for a ruptured appendix. I never even got to see him after he went in for a fever and gut ache, our moron lieutenant simply informing me that he'd died. "Oh, Bender. Yeah, look, Richards is dead." The last and best of my friends to go in my war. And if this marks the end of Richards' war, I offer this epilogue. A year later, I found myself driving through Cedar Falls, Iowa, parking in front of a bungalow with an American flag on the brick porch, removing my cap and ringing the doorbell. Richard's wife was a short, boxy thing, and I told her the best lie I could imagine, that his last words had been her name. And I handed his little boy the box with my Luger in it, said his daddy had taken it off a German soldier, and as I looked down on those ginger cowlicks, I ached for my own son, for the heir I would never have, for someone to redeem the life I was already planning to waste. And when Richard's God-sweet boy asked whether his father had been brave at the war, I said with all honesty, "Your dad was the bravest man I ever knew." And he was, because on the day I met the girl, brave Richard said, "Just go. Keep your Luger. I'll cover for you. Just tell me all about it afterward." If, in this confession of fear and discomfort during my war, I have portrayed myself as lacking in valor, I offer this evidence of my Galahad-like heart. I had no intention of laying a hand on that girl, and I needed Richards to know it, that I risked death and dishonor not to nick my willy, but simply to walk with a pretty girl on a road at night, to feel that sweet normalcy again. "Richards," I said, I'm not going to touch her." I think he could see it was telling the truth, because he looked pained. "Then Christ, let me go with her." I patted his shoulder, grabbed my rifle, and ran down the road to catch her. She was a fast walker, and when I came upon her, she had edged over to the side of the road. Up close, she was older than I'd thought, maybe 25. She took me in warily. I put her at ease with my bilingual charm. "Scusi, bella, fare una passeggiata, per favore?" She smiled. "Yes, you may walk with me," she said in English. She slowed and took my arm. "But only if you stop wiping your ass on my language." Ah, so it was love. Maria's mother had raised 3 sons and 3 daughters in this village. Her father had died early in the war, and her brothers had been conscripted at 16, 15, and the last at 12, dragged off to dig Italian trenches, and later, German fortifications. She prayed that at least one of her brothers was alive somewhere north of what was left of the Linea Gotica, but she didn't hold out much hope. Maria gave me the quick history of her little village during the war, squeezed like a washcloth of its young men by Mussolini, then squeezed again by the partisans, again by the retreating Germans, until there were no males between the ages of 8 and 55, the town bombed, strafed, and picked clean of food and supplies. Maria had studied English at a convent school, and with the invasion found work as a nurse's aide at an American field hospital. She was gone weeks at a time, but always returned to the village to check on her mother and sisters. "So when this is all finished," I asked, "do you have a nice young man to marry?" "There was a boy, but I doubt he's alive. No, when this is over, I will care for my mother. She is a widow whose 3 sons were taken from her. When she's gone, maybe I'll get one of you Americans to take me to New York City. I'll live in the Empire State Building, eat ice cream every night in fancy restaurants, and grow fat." "I can take you to Wisconsin. You can get fat there." "Ah, Wisconsin," she said. "The cheese and the dairy fields." She waved her hand in front of her face as if Wisconsin lay just beyond the scrub trees alongside the road. "Cows, farms, and Madison, moon over the river, and the College of Badgers. It is cold in the winter, but in the summer there are beautiful farm girls with pigtails and red cheeks." She could do that for any state you named. So many American boys in her hospital had taken time to reminisce about the place they came from, often before they died. "Idaho? The deep lakes and big mountains, endless trees and beautiful farm girls with pigtails and red cheeks." "No farm girl for me," I said. "You'll find one after the war," she said. I said that after the war I wanted to write a book. She cocked her head. "What kind of book?" "A novel. About all of this. Maybe a funny novel." She became somber. Writing a book was an important thing to do, she said, not a joke. "Oh, no," I said. "I don't mean to joke about it. I don't mean that sort of funny." She asked what other kind of funny there was, and I didn't know what to say. We were within sight of her village, a cluster of gray shadows that sat like a cap on the dark hill in front of us. "The sort of funny that makes you sad, too," I said. She looked at me curiously, and just then a bird or a bat flushed from the bushes ahead, and we both started. I put my arm around Maria's shoulder, and I can't say how it happened, but suddenly we were off the road, and I was on my back, and she was lying on top of me in a grove of lemon trees, the unripe fruit above me like hanging stones. I kissed her lips and cheeks and neck, and she quickly undid my pants and held me between her 2 hands, stroking me expertly with 1 soft hand and caressing me with the other, as if she had read some top-secret army manual on this maneuver. And she was exceptional at it, far better than I'd ever managed to be, so that in no time I was making snuffling noises, and she pressed against me, and I smelled lemons and dirt and her. And the world fell away as she shifted her body and aimed me perfectly away from her pretty dress, like a farm wife directing a stream of cow's milk toward the unripe lemons, all of this happening in less than a minute, without her having to so much as loosen the bow in her hair. She said, "There you go." To this day, these three words remain the most lovely, sad, awful thing I have ever heard. "There you go." I started crying. "What is it?" she said. "My feet hurt," was all I could manage. But of course I wasn't crying because of my feet. And while I was overcome with gratitude toward Maria, and with regret and nostalgia and relief over being alive this late in my war, I wasn't crying for those reasons either. I was crying because clearly I wasn't the first brute that Maria had so efficiently and delicately brought to fruition using only her hands. I was crying because, behind her speed and skill, her mastery of technique, there could only exist an awful history. This was a maneuver learned after encounters with other soldiers, when they pushed her to the ground and she wasn't able to deflect them using only her hands. "There you go." "Oh, Maria," I cried. "I'm sorry." And I was clearly not the first brute to cry in her presence, either, because she knew just what was needed, unbuttoning the top of her blue dress and putting my head between her breasts, whispering, "Shh, Wisconsin, shh." Her skin so soft and buttersweet, so wet with my tears that I cried harder, and she said, "Shh, Wisconsin," and I buried my face between those breasts as if her skin were my home, as if Wisconsin lay there, and to this day it is the greatest place I've ever been, that narrow ribbed valley between those lovely hills. After a moment I stopped crying and managed to regain a bit of dignity. And 5 minutes later, after I had given her all of my money and cigarettes and pledged my undying love and sworn that I would return, I hobbled shamefully back to my sentry post, insisting to my disappointed, soon-to-be-dead best friend Richards that I did nothing more than walk her home. God, this life is a cold, brittle thing. And yet it's all there is. That night I settled into my mummy bag, no longer myself, but a played-out husk, a shell. Years passed, and I found myself still a husk, still in that moment, still in the day my war ended, the day I realized, as all survivors must, that being alive isn't the same thing as living. There you go. A year later, after I delivered the Luger to Richard's son, I stopped at a little bar in Cedar Falls and had one of the 6 million drinks I've had since that day. The barmaid asked me what I was doing in town, and I told her, "Visiting my boy." Then she asked about my son, that good imaginary boy whose biggest failing was that he didn't exist. I told her that he was a fine kid, and that I was delivering a war souvenir to him. She was intrigued. "What was it?" she asked. "What thing of significance that I brought home from the war for my boy?" "Socks," I answered. "But in the end, this is what I brought home from my war. This single sad story about how I lived while a better man died. How beneath the scraggly lemon branch on a little dirt track outside the village of R, I received a glorious 20-second hand job from a girl who was desperately trying to avoid being raped by me. Chapter 5. A Michael Dean Production. Recently, Hollywood Hills, California. The Dean of Hollywood reclines in silk pajamas on a chaise on his lanai, sipping a fresco with ginseng and looking out over the trees to the glittering lights of Beverly Hills. Open in his lap is a script, the sequel to Night Ravengers, Exterior, Los Angeles. Night. A black Trans Am speeds past a burning Getty Museum. His assistant, Claire, has pronounced the script not even good by crap standards. And while Claire's critical limbo stick is set too high in this case, given the shrinking margin in movies and the shit business the first Night Ravagers did, Michael has to agree. This is a view he's looked at for 20 years. And yet somehow, it seems new to him this late afternoon. The sun sliding over the green and glassed hills. Michael sighs with the contentedness of a man back on top. It's remarkable the difference a year can make. Not long ago, he'd stopped seeing the beauty in this view, in everything. He'd begun to fear that the end had come. Not death. Dean men never succumbed before 90. But something worse. Obsolescence. He was in a terrible slump, with nothing resembling a hit in almost a decade. His only recent credit of any kind, the first Night Ravagers, which was really more of a discredit. He'd also suffered through the debacle surrounding his memoir, when his publisher's lawyers decided the book he wanted to write was libelous, self-serving, and impossible to fact-check. And his editor sent a ghostwriter to turn it into some strange hybrid of autobiography and self-help book. His run seemingly over, Michael was on his way to being one of those ancients who haunt the dining room at the Riviera Country Club, spooning soup and dithering on about Doris Day and Daryl Zanuck. But it turned out the old Dean magic wasn't quite finished. It's what he loves about this town and this business. One simple idea, one good pitch, and you're back in. He didn't even entirely understand the pitch that brought him back, this hook book. He only pretends to grasp all the computer, bloggy, twitty, googaw business. But he could tell by the reactions of his producing partner Danny, and especially his tight-assed, impossible-to-please assistant Claire, that it was big. So he did what he does best, pitched the shit out of it. And now Michael Dean is back on every call sheet in town, on every master list for every spec script and sizzle reel. In fact, his biggest problem now is the restrictive life raft arrangement he made with the studio, giving it a first look at and a big cut of whatever he does. Thankfully, his lawyers believe they have a way out of this, too, and Michael has already started looking for office space elsewhere. Just thinking about being out on his own makes him feel 30 again, a tingling excitement in his lap. Oh, wait. Is that the pill he took an hour ago? Ah, yes. There it is. Kicking in right on schedule. Beneath the script, decrepit nerve terminals and endothelial cells release nitric oxide into the corpus cavernosum, which stimulates the synthesis of cyclic GMP, stiffening the well-used smooth muscle cells and flooding the old spongy tissue with blood. The script rises in his lap like the flag at Iwo Jima. Hello there. Michael sets the script on the garden table next to his fresca, pushes himself up and starts toward the house for Kathy. His silk pajama pants straining, Michael shuffles past the gravity pool, the life-size chessboard, the koi pond, Kathy's exercise ball and yoga mat, the wrought iron outdoor Tuscan brunch table. He spots wife number 4 through the open kitchen door in yoga pants and tight t-shirt. He gets the full protuberant effect of his recent investment in her. The top of the line viscous silicone gel sacs implanted in her retro mammary cavities for minimal capsular contracture and scarring between breast tissue and pectoralis muscle, replacing the old, slightly drooping silicone sacs. It's hot. Kathy's always telling him not to shuffle. It makes you look 100. And Michael reminds himself to pick up his feet. She's just turned her back to him when he steps through the open slider into the kitchen. "Excuse me, miss," he says to his wife, positioning himself so she can see his pajama tent pole. "You order the wood pizza?" But she has those infernal earbuds in and hasn't seen or heard him. Or maybe she's just pretending she hasn't. When things were at their worst the last 2 years, Michael sensed a whiff of condescension from her, a nurse's on-duty patience in her tone. Kathy has reached the magical half-his-age mark, 36 to his 72, Michael making a late career of 30-something women. It's scandalous when a man his age dips into the 20s, but no one flinches when the woman is in her 30s. Here, you could be 100, date a 30-year-old, and still seem respectable. Unfortunately, Kathy is also 5 inches taller than him, and this is the truly unbridgeable gap. He sometimes gets an unpleasant picture in his mind of their lovemaking, of him scurrying across her hilly landscape like a randy elf. He comes around the counter and positions himself so she can see the disturbance in his pajama pants. She looks up, then down, then up again. She removes her earbuds. "Hi, honey, what's up?" Before he can say the obvious, Michael's cell phone vibrates, jumping on the counter between them. Kathy slides the buzzing phone to him, and if not for the chemical help, her lack of interest might endanger Michael's condition. He checks the number on the phone. Claire? At 4:45 on a wild-pitch Friday? What could this be? His assistant is whip-smart, and he has the superstitious belief that she might have that rare quality, luck, but she makes life so tough on herself. The girl anguishes over everything, is constantly measuring herself, her expectations, her progress, her sense of worth. It's exhausting. Michael has even become suspicious that she's looking for another job. He has a sixth sense for such things, and this is probably the reason he holds up a finger to Kathy and takes the call. "What is it, Claire?" She rambles, chatters, titters. "My God," he thinks. "This girl with her unshakable upper-middle-brow taste, her world-weary faux cynicism." He always warns her about cynicism. It is as thin as an $80 suit. She's a great reader, but she lacks the cool clarity required for producing. "I don't love it," she'll say about an idea, as if love had anything to do with it. Michael's producing partner, Danny, calls Claire the canary, as in coal mine, and half-jokingly suggests they use her as a reverse barometer. "If the canary likes it, we pass." For instance, even though she admitted Hookbook was a big idea, she begged him not to produce it. "Claire, after all the films you've produced, is this really the kind of thing you want to be known for making?" Michael, "Money is the kind of thing I want to be known for making." On the phone, Claire is at her mumbling, apologetic worst, droning on about Wild Pitch Friday, about some old Italian guy and a writer who happens to speak his language, and Michael starts to interrupt. "Claire!" But the girl won't even pause for breath. "Claire!" he says again, but his assistant won't let him in. "The Italian guy is looking for an old actress, somebody named..." And Claire utters a name that momentarily takes away his breath. "Di More?" Michael Dean's legs go out from under him. The phone drops from his right hand onto the counter as the fingers on his left hand skitter for purchase. Only Kathy's quick reflexes keep him from falling all the way to the floor, from possibly hitting his head on the counter and impaling himself on his erection. "Michael, are you okay?" Kathy asks. "Is it another stroke?" "Di More." So this is what ghosts are like, Michael thinks. Not white corporeal figures haunting your dreams, but old names buzzed over cell phones. He waves his wife off and grabs the phone from the counter. "It's not a stroke, Kathy. Let me go." He concentrates on breathing. A man so rarely gets the full sweep of his life. But here is Michael Dean, chemically enhanced erection straining his silk pajamas in the open kitchen of his Hollywood Hills home, holding on to a tiny wireless telephone and speaking across 50 years. "Don't move. I'll be right there." The first impression one gets of Michael Dean is as of a man constructed of wax, or perhaps prematurely embalmed. After all these years, it may be impossible to trace the sequence of facials, spa treatments, mud baths, cosmetic procedures, lifts and staples, collagen implants, outpatient touch-ups, tannings, Botox injections, cyst and growth removals, and stem cell injections that have caused a 72-year-old man to have the face of a 9-year-old Filipino girl. Suffice it to say that, upon meeting Michael for the first time, many people stare open-mouthed, unable to look away from his glistening, vaguely lifelike face. Sometimes they cock their heads to get a better angle, and Michael mistakes their morbid fascination for attraction, or respect, or surprise that someone his age could look this good. And it is this basic misunderstanding that causes him to be even more aggressive about fighting the aging process. It's not just that he gets younger looking each year, that's common enough here. It's as if he is somehow transforming himself, evolving into a different being altogether. And this transformation defies any attempts to explain it. Trying to picture what Michael Dean looked like as a young man in Italy 50 years ago, based on his appearance now, is like standing on Wall Street trying to understand the topography of Manhattan Island before the Dutch arrived. As this strange man shuffles toward him, Shane Wheeler can't quite get his mind around the idea that this lacquered elf is the famous Michael Dean. "Is that?" "Yes," Claire simply says. "Try not to stare." But this is like ordering someone to stay dry in a rainstorm. Especially when he shuffle walks, the contradiction is just too much. As if a boy's face has been grafted onto the body of a dying man. He's dressed, strangely, too, in silk pajama pants and a long wool coat that covers most of his torso. If Shane didn't know this was one of the most famous producers in Hollywood, he might go with escaped mental patient. "Thanks for calling, Claire," Michael Dean says once he's reached them. He points to the door of the bungalow. "The Italian's in there?" "Yeah," she says. "We told him we'd be right back." Claire has never heard Michael so shaken. She tries to imagine what could have happened between these two to upset Michael this way. To have him call from the car and ask Claire and the translator to meet him outside so he could take a minute before seeing Pasquale. "After all these years," Michael says. He usually speaks in a clipped hurry, like a 40s gangster rushing his lines. But now his voice seems strained, uneasy, although his face remains remarkably neutral, placid. Claire steps forward, takes Michael's arm. "Are you okay, Michael?"
"I'm fine."
And only then does he look at Shane.
"You must be the translator."
"Oh, well, I studied for a year in Florence, so I do speak a little Italian. But actually, I'm a writer. I'm here to pitch a film idea. Shane Wheeler?" There is no recognition on Michael Dean's face that the man is even speaking English. "Anyway, it's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Dean. I loved your book." Michael Dean bristles at the mention of his autobiography, which his editor and ghostwriter turned into a how-to-pitch-in-Hollywood primer. He spins back to Claire.
"What did the Italian say, exactly?"
"Like I told you on the phone," Claire said. "Not much." Michael Dean looked at Shane again, as if there might be something in the translation that Claire has missed.
"Well,
Shane says, glancing at Claire. "He just said that he met you in 1962, and then he told us about this actress who came to his town, D..." Michael holds up his hand to keep Shane from saying the whole name. And he looks back to Claire to pick up, as if, in this verbal relay, he might find some answers. "At first," Claire says, "I thought he was pitching a story about this actress in Italy. He said she was sick, and I asked with what?"
"Cancer," Michael Dean says.
"Yeah, that's what he said." Michael Dean nods.
"Does he want money?"
"He didn't say anything about money. He said he wanted to find this actress." Michael runs a hand through his post-naturally plugged and woven sandy hair. He nods toward the bungalow.
And he's in there now?
Yes, I told him I was going to come get you. Michael, what's this about?
About? This is about everything.
He looks Claire over, all the way down to her heels.
Do you know what my real talent is, Claire?
Claire can't imagine a satisfying answer to a question like that, and thankfully Michael doesn't wait for an answer.
I see what people want. I have a kind of X-ray vision for desire. Ask some guy what he wants to watch on TV and he'll say news, opera, foreign films. But put a box in his house and what's he watch? Blowjobs and car crashes. Does that mean the country is full of lying degenerates? No. They want news and opera, but it's not what they want. What I do is look at someone.
He narrows his eyes at Claire's clothing again.
And I see straight to her desire, to what she truly wants. A director won't take a job and insists it isn't about the money. I go get him more money. An actor says he wants to work in the States to be near his family. I get him a job overseas so he can get away from his family. That ability has served me for almost 50 years.
He doesn't finish. He takes a deep breath in through his nose and smiles at Shane, as if just remembering he was there.
Those stories of people trading their souls, you don't really understand them until you get a little older.
Claire is stunned. Michael never reflects like this, never describes himself as old or older. If there is one remarkable thing about Michael, Claire would have said an hour ago, it is that for someone with such a rich history, he never looks back, never mentions the starlets he's had or the movies he's made, never questions himself, never bemoans the changing culture, the death of movies, the sorts of things she and everyone else here whine about constantly. He loves what the culture loves. Its sheer speed, its callous promiscuity, its defections and deflections, its level-seeking ability to always go shallower. To him, the culture can do no wrong. Don't ever give in to cynicism, he's always telling her. Believe in everything. He is a shark ceaselessly swimming forward into the culture, into the future. And yet here he is now, staring off, as if he's looking directly into the past, a man stricken by something that happened 50 years ago. He takes another deep breath and nods at the bungalow.
Okay, he says. I'm ready. Let's go.
Pasquale Tursi narrows his eyes and stares at Michael Dean.
Can this possibly be the same man?
They are sitting in Michael's office, Michael sliding easily behind his desk, Pasquale and Shane on the couch, Claire in a chair she's dragged in. Michael has kept his heavy coat on and his face is placid, but he squirms a bit, uncomfortable in his chair.
Good to see you again, my friend,
Michael tells Pasquale, but it comes across as oddly insincere.
It's been a long time.
Pasquale simply nods. Then he turns to Shane and asks quietly,
Sta male?
No, Shane says, and tries to think of how to tell Pasquale that Michael Dean is not sick, but has had numerous procedures and surgeries. Molto, ambulatori.
What did you tell him?
Michael asks.
He said you look good, and I just said you take care of yourself.
Michael thanks him, and then asks Shane,
Will you ask if he wants money?
Pasquale jerks at the word money. He looks mildly disgusted.
No, I come to find Di More.
Michael Dean nods, a bit pained.
I have no idea where she is, Michael says. I'm sorry.
Then he looks at Claire as if for help.
I googled her, Claire says. I tried different spellings, looked at the IMDb listing for Cleopatra. There's nothing.
No,
Michael says, chewing his lip.
There wouldn't be. It wasn't a real name.
He rubs his lineless face again, considers Pasquale, and turns to Shane.
Please, translate for me. Tell him that I am sorry for the way I behaved back then.
Lui è dispiaciuto, Shane says.
Pasquale nods slightly, acknowledging the words if not accepting them. Whatever is between these two men, Shane thinks, it runs deep. Then there is a buzzing, and Claire brings her cell phone to her ear. She answers it and says calmly into the device,
You're gonna have to go get your own chicken.
All three men stare at her. She clicks off the call. Sorry, she says, and then opens her mouth to explain, but thinks better of it. Michael looks back to Pasquale and Shane again.
Tell him I'll find her, that it's the least I can do.
Egli vi aiuterà a, trovarla.
Pasquale simply nods again.
Tell him that I plan to do this right away, that I consider it an honor to be able to help, and a chance for redemption, to complete the circle of this thing that I started so many years ago. And please, tell him that I never had any intention of hurting anyone.
Shane rubs his brow, looks from Michael to Claire.
I'm not sure how to... Lui vuole fare il bene.
That's it? Claire says.
He said 50 words, you said like 4.
Shane feels stung by the criticism.
I told you I'm not a translator. I don't know how to say all of that. I just said he wants to do good now.
No, that's right, Michael says.
He looks with admiration at Shane, and for a moment, Shane imagines parlaying this translation job into a screenwriting deal.
That's exactly what I want to do, Michael says. I want to do good, yes.
Then Michael turns to Claire.
This is our number one priority now, Claire.
Shane watches all of this with fascination and disbelief. This morning he was sitting in his parents' basement. Now he's in Michael Dean's office. The Michael Dean's office. While the legendary producer barks orders to his development assistant. In the words of the prophet Mamet, act as if. Go with it. Be confident, and the world responds to your confidence, rewards your faith. Michael Dean pulls an old Rolodex from a desk drawer and begins spinning it while he talks to Claire.
I'm gonna get Emmett Byers to work on this right away. Can you get Mr. Torsey and the translator settled in a hotel?
Look, Shane Wheeler says, surprising even himself. I told you I'm not a translator, I'm a writer.
They all turn to look at him. And for a moment, Shane questions his resolve, recalls the dark period he's just come through. Before that, Shane Wheeler always knew he was headed for great things. Everyone told him so. Not just his parents, but strangers too. And while he didn't exactly tear it up in college and Europe and grad school, all on his parents' dime, as Sandra liked to point out, he never doubted he'd be a success. But during the collapse of his brief marriage, Sandra and the crabby marriage counselor, who clearly took her side, described a very different pattern. A boy whose parents never said no, who never required him to do chores or to get a job, who stepped in whenever he got into trouble. Exhibit A, the spring break thing with the police in Mexico. Who supported him financially long after they should have. Here he was, almost 30, and he'd never had a real job. Here he was, 7 years out of college, 2 years out of his master's program, married, and his mother still sent him a monthly clothing allowance?
She likes buying my clothes, Shane argued. Isn't it cruel to make her stop?
In that doomed final month of the marriage, in what felt like a live autopsy of his manhood, Sandra tried to make him feel better by insisting it wasn't entirely his fault. He was a part of a ruined generation of young men coddled by their parents, by their mothers especially, raised on unearned self-esteem, in a bubble of over-affection, in a sad incubator of phony achievement.
Men like you never had to fight, so you have no fight in you, she said,
Men like you grew up flaccid and weak, she said. Men like you are milk-fed veal. And what milk-fed Shane did next only proved her point. After a particularly heated argument, when Sandra went to work, he moved out, taking the car they'd bought together and heading for Costa Rica and a job on a coffee plantation he'd heard about from some friends. But the car died in Mexico, and broke and carless, Shane made his way back to Portland and moved back in with his parents. Since then, he's come to regret his behavior and has apologized to Sandra, even sending her the irregular check for her part of the car, birthday money from his grandparents mostly, and promising that soon he'd pay her back completely. The most painful thing about Sandra's milk-fed veal rant, as he's begun to think of it, was not the truth of it, which was undeniable. Yeah, she was right. He could see that. The awful thing is that he didn't see it before. As Sandra said with incredulity, I think you really believe your shit. And he did. He really believed his own shit. And now, after she'd blown it all up, he really didn't. For the first few months of their divorce, Shane felt empty and alone in his humiliation. Without his old belief in his slow-brewing talents, Shane was rudderless, adrift, and he sank into the depths of depression. Which is why, he realizes now, he's got to make the most of this second chance, to go out and prove that ACT wasn't simply a motto or a tattoo, a childish delusion, but the truth. He is not milk-fed veal. He is a bull, a man on the come, a winner. Shane takes a deep breath in the studio bungalow offices of Michael Dean Productions, looks from Claire Silver to Michael Dean and back, and with all the old Mammoth-inspired confidence he can muster, says, I came here to pitch a movie, and I'm not translating another word until you hear it. Chapter 6. The Cave Paintings. April 1962. Porto Vergogna, Italy. The narrow trail was etched into the cliff face like bunting on the side of a wedding cake, a series of switchbacks zigzagging the steep ledge behind the village. Pasquale stepped carefully along the old goat path and continually looked back to make sure Dee was behind him. Near the top, the trail had been washed out by this year's heavy winter rains, and Pasquale reached back for Dee's warm hand as the path gave way to bare rock. At the last switchback, an unlikely orange grove had been planted on the cliffside. 6 gnarled trees, 3 on each side, tied to the rocks with wire to keep them from blowing over the side.
"Is a little more only," Pasquale said. "I'm fine," she said,
and they made their way along the last stretch of trail, the lip of the cliff just over their heads now, Porto Vergogna peeking out from the rocks 60 vertical meters beneath them.
"You feel bad? Stop or go?" Pasquale asked over his shoulder.
He was becoming accustomed to speaking English again.
"No, let's keep going. It's nice to be out walking."
Finally, they crested the cliff and stood on the ledge above the village, the drop-off right at their feet, wind ripe, sea pulsing, foam curling on the rocks below. Dee stood near the edge, so frail that Pasquale had the urge to grab her, to keep her from being blown away by the wind.
"It's gorgeous, Pasquale," she said.
The sky was hazy clear beneath a smear of faint cloud, washed out blue against the darker sea. On top of the cliffs, trails spiderwebbed the hills. He pointed up one trail to the northwest up the coast.
"This way, Cinque Terre."
Then he pointed east behind them, over the hills toward the bay.
"This way, Spezia."
Finally, he turned to the south and showed her the trail they were going to take. It carved the hills for another kilometer before dipping back into the craggy, unpopulated valley along the shoreline.
"Porto Venere, this way, is easy at first, then difficult. Only for goats is trail from Venere."
She followed Pasquale on the easy part, a series of switchbacks up and down the pitched hills. Where they met the sea, the cliffs had been carved by shore break, but here on top the terrain was friendlier. Still, a few times, Dee and Pasquale had to reach for scraggly trees and vines to descend the steep hills and climb the sharp creases. At the crest of a rocky knob, Dee paused at the remnants of a stone foundation. Roman ruins, rounded by weather and wind until they looked like old teeth. "What was this?" she asked, pushing brush away from the smooth stone. Pasquale shrugged. "For 1,000 years, armies used these points to look out over the sea. There were so many ruins up here, Pasquale hardly noticed them anymore. Sometimes the rubble of these old garrisons gave him a dull sadness. To think that this was all that was left of an empire. What mark could a man like him ever leave? A beach? A cliffside tennis court?"
"Come," he said, "is a little more only."
They walked another 50 meters, and Pasquale pointed out where the hillside trail started down the cliffs into Porto Venere, still more than 1 kilometer away. Then taking Dee by the hand, Pasquale left the trail and scrambled over some boulders, pushed through brush, and they emerged on a point with a stunning view of the coastline in both directions. Dee gasped.
"Come,"
Pasquale said again, and he lowered himself onto a rocky shelf. After a brief hesitation, Dee followed, and they came to what he had wanted to show her. A small, concrete dome, the same color as the rocks and boulders around it. Only its uniformity and the 3 long rectangular machine gun turret windows gave it away as man-made. A machine gun pillbox bunker left over from World War II. Pasquale helped her climb on top of it, the wind dancing in her hair.
"This was from the war?" she asked.
"Yes," Pasquale said. "Everywhere still is the war. Was to see ships."
"And was there fighting here?"
"No."
Pasquale waved at the cliffs behind them.
"Too..."
He frowned. He wanted to say lonely again, but that wasn't quite right.
"Isolato?"
he asked in Italian.
"Isolated?"
"Sì, yes."
Pasquale smiled.
"Only war here is boys play shoot at boats."
The concrete for the pillbox had been poured into the boulders behind it, so that it wasn't visible from above, and it looked like just another stone from below. Jutting from the brow of the cliff, the bunker had 3 open horizontal windows. Inside was a machine gun nest with a 280-degree view on the jagged cove of Porto Vergogna to the northwest. And beyond that, the rocky shoreline and the less drastic cliffs behind Rio Maggiore, the last village of the Cinque Terre. To the south, the mountains receded to the village of Porto Venere, and beyond that, Palmaria Island. On both sides, the sea foamed on the rocky points, and the steep cliffs rose into green bursts of raggedy pine, clusters of fruit trees, and the furrowed beginnings of the Cinque Terre vineyards. Pasquale's father used to say that ancient people believed this coast was the end of the flat world.
"It's wonderful," she said, standing atop the abandoned pillbox.
Pasquale was pleased that she liked it.
"Is good place to think, yes?"
She smiled back at him. "And what do you think about up here, Pasquale?"
Such an odd question. What does anyone think about anywhere?
When he was a kid, he'd imagine the rest of the world up here. Now, mostly, he thought about his first love, Amedea, whom he'd left behind in Florence. He replayed their last day together, and wondered if there was something else he could have said. But occasionally, his thoughts up here were of a different order. Thoughts about time and his place in the world. Big, quiet thoughts, difficult to speak of in Italian, let alone English. And yet he wanted to try.
"I think all people in the world. And I am one only, yes?"
Pasquale said. and sometimes I see the moon here. Yes, is for everyone. All people look at one moon. Yes? Here, Firenze, America. For all people, all time, same moon, yes?
He saw lovely Amedea, staring at the moon from the narrow window of her family's house in Florence.
Sometimes this same moon, it is good, but sometimes more sad, yes?
She stared at him a moment as it registered.
Yes,
she said finally.
I think so too.
She reached over and squeezed his hand. He felt drained from trying to speak English, but pleased to have communicated something abstract and personal after 2 days of
"How is room?"
and "More soap?" Dee looked up the coast. Pasquale knew she was watching for Orencio's boat, and he assured her they would be able to see it from up here. She sat, curled up on her knees, staring to the northeast where the soil was better than in rocky Porto Vergogna, and the gradual cliffs were seamed with parallel rows of grapevines. Pasquale pointed back down toward his village.
"Do you see this rock? I am build a tennis court there."
She looked perplexed.
"Where?"
"There."
They had climbed and gone half a kilometer to the south, and so he could just make out the cluster of boulders beyond the village.
"Will be primo tennis."
"Wait, you're putting a tennis court on the cliffs?"
"For make my hotel destinazione primaria, yes? Very luxury."
"I guess I don't see where you're going to fit a tennis court." He leaned in closer and extended his arm, and she pressed her cheek against his shoulder to look straight down his arm past his pointing finger, to make sure she was seeing the right place. There was a jolt of electricity in his shoulder, where her cheek touched him, and Pasquale's breath fell short again. He'd assumed that his romantic education, courtesy of Amedea, had done away with the old nervousness he used to feel around girls. But here he was, shaking like a child. She was incredulous.
"You're building a tennis court there?" "Yes, I make the rocks flat."
He remembered the English word.
"Cantilever."
"Yes?" "Will be very famous.
Best tennis in Levante. Numero uno court rising from the sea."
"But won't the tennis balls just fly off the edge?" He looked from her to the boulders and back, wondering if she knew the game.
"No, the players hit the ball."
He held his hands apart.
"On this side and this side."
"Yeah, but when they miss..." He just stared at her. "Have you ever played tennis, Pasquale?" This was a sore subject, sports. Even though Pasquale was tall for his family, over 1.8 meters, he had played no sports growing up in Porto Vergogna. For a long time, this shame was at the front of his insecurities.
"I see many pictures," he said, "and I make measure from a book."
"When the player on the seaside misses it, won't the balls fly into the sea?" Pasquale rubbed his jaw and considered it. She smiled. "Maybe you could put up high fences." Pasquale stared out at the sea, imagining it covered with bobbing yellow tennis balls.
"Yes," he said. "A fence, yes, of course."
He was an imbecile. "I'm sure it'll be a wonderful court," she said, and turned back to the sea. Pasquale looked at Dee's sharp profile, the wind snapping her hair.
"The man who comes today, you are in love with him?"
He was surprised at himself for asking, and when she turned back, Pasquale looked down.
"I hope it's okay I ask this."
"Oh, of course." She took a deep breath and blew air out. "Unfortunately, I think I am, yes. But I shouldn't be. He's not a good man to fall in love with."
"And he is in love?"
"Oh, yes," she said. "He's in love with himself, too." It took a second to register, but Pasquale was delighted by her joke.
"Ah,"
he said,
"very funny."
Another gust riffled Dee's hair, and she held it down against her head. Pasquale, I read the story I found in my room by the American writer.